Case number 08-5133, Oglala Sioux Tribe of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation Appellant versus United States Army Corps of Engineers et al. Mr. Gonzalez for the appellant, Mr. Ludman for the appellees.
Good morning.
May it please the court. The Oglala Sioux tribe does have legally protected interests in the Corps lands, contrary to the claims of the government. The tribe is not claiming ownership or title to any lands in this case. Any claims to title to land is barred by the Quiet Title Act and the Indian Claims Commission Act's statutes of limitations. We fully agree with the government that based on Block versus North Dakota, the Supreme Court case, and based on Navajo Nation versus New Mexico, the courts have made it very clear that all plaintiffs cannot sue the United States for land because they are barred by the statute of limitations in both the Quiet Title Act and the Indian Claims Commission Act in the case of Indian tribes. So what is our legally protected interest in these lands? We are only claiming title and ownership to the cultural items embedded in those core lands. That's what this case is all about. And we made that very clear in our complaint in paragraph 44. Paragraph 43 defines what we can claim under what's called the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act. It's Section 25, United States Code, Section 3002 provides that Indian tribes can claim ownership and control of these cultural items. And certain things have to meet certain requirements to get ownership and control. Under subsection A, 2, C, 1, and 2, it provides that tribes can claim these cultural items if they can show there's no lineal descendants that have first priority, and if they can show that they have Aboriginal title to these lands and the strongest claim. That's subsections 1 and 2. The tribes have to put in a claim for these lands, and Oglala Sioux tribe has, as noted by the district court in paragraph 44 of the complaint. So the Oglala Sioux tribe has.
Practically, what do you want? Do you want a declaration that says what?
What is happening here is that the Corps is violating WRDA, the Water Resource Development Act, in transferring these lands. And the reason they're violating WRDA is because WRDA 99, Title 6, Section B3 and C2 provide that you cannot transfer these lands if they are within the boundaries of an existing Indian reservation. And we are asserting that these lands are within the boundaries of an Indian reservation.
We have to address the issue of whether or not they're within your reservation.
That's lands. Correct. I mean, we're just trying to comply with WRDA here.
Isn't that the claim that you dropped?
I'm sorry.
Isn't that the claim that you dropped after our earlier decision? Didn't you? You just said your claim is that the Corps is violating the Act, right? Yes. The Water Resources Act. But that's the claim that you dropped, isn't it? This claim, aren't I right about that? Didn't you drop that claim?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor.
No?
I've never dropped any claim.
Didn't you drop several claims when you filed your amended complaint?
Oh, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
What we dropped when we amended our complaint was the claims that were the same claims in the Crow Creek Crow Creek litigation. We retained three claims, which are in the complaint, and we added one new claim, and Judge Kessler granted our motion to amend. So the claims that we dropped are not in dispute in this litigation.
Right, and the fourth claim, I just found my notes here. You just
the
said
the fourth claim, I'm sorry.
Which you dropped. The fourth claim in the original complaint says that this secretary is without authority to transfer title to South Dakota, right? You dropped that claim.
No, no, we didn't drop that claim.
You didn't?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, we are claiming title and ownership and control under NAGPRA.
Well, can I, just to avoid
yes, Judge Tatel.
So I'm not confused about this. Am I right that the claims that are now before us are, in the amended complaint, you have two treaty-based claims, right?
That's correct.
One that the Corps, that the government has refused to acknowledge that the boundaries of the Great Sioux Nation were never changed, right? And the second, that the transfers are being made without its consent, without the tribe's consent, under the 1868 treaty, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, but neither of those claim that that the Corps is violating the act authorizing the transfers.
Yes, we are claiming that that the court violated the 1868 treaty because Section 28 of the 1889 Act provided that before the 89 Act could go into effect, the government had to, only if, I think is the language, only if the government obtained the consent of the and acceptance of the Sioux tribes. And we have shown that the government did not do that. And in fact, Judge Kessler even made a finding that the requisite consent was not obtained in this litigation.
Back to what Judge Tatel brought up, because on page 537 Fed Sup 2nd at 167, Judge Kessler says, on July 25, 2003, the Oglala tribe responded to the show cause, conceding that the amended complaint's first four claims for relief were directly addressed in the Crow Creek decision and should thus be dismissed without prejudice. Mm-hmm. Plaintiff then stated that its fifth, sixth, and seventh claims were still ripe. So we're talking about this fourth claim. I think, Judge Tatel, is that that's his question, that, and according to the district judge, you agreed to have that dismissed without prejudice. That's what she says. And are you saying you haven't dropped it, or?
We dropped all the claims except three claims.
Okay.
And the three claims that we
are the
retained are right in the complaint.
The fifth, sixth, and seventh.
Right.
Okay.
I have a question about this. Let's assume that you're right about this. That is that that under the Fort Laramie Treaty and under the 1889 Act, the tribe's boundary rights have been preserved. That is, that they remain unchanged, right? That's your theory, correct?
Yes.
Because there was never proper consent.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Now, if you're right about that, what effect will this transfer have on those rights, given Section 607 of the Act, which says that nothing in this title diminishes for any external boundary of an Indian reservation?
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like under the statute, 607,
mm-hmm,
that whatever boundary rights the tribe has now continue after the transfer.
That's correct. Section 607 does state that.
Right. So then there's no harm to you from this transfer.
Well, there is harm.
Well, not if your rights are preserved by the transferring statute.
The harm is...
Reservation boundaries and ownership are not equal.
Oh, that's correct.
And that's the problem that you're talking about.
In the United States versus New Mexico, the Navajo tribe had trouble discerning the distinction between title to land and boundaries. And the 10th Circuit stated in its opinion that there is an important distinction between title and boundaries. And even though you have...
That's because the reservations were opened up to homesteading, and so whites came in, and it's been so much litigation in the Supreme Court about whether the fact that they were open to homesteading changed the boundary line for jurisdictional purposes.
Well, the intent of Congress paramount in those diminishment cases.
Didn't you say you were not claiming title to the land?
That's a problem, yeah.
We are not claiming title to the land.
So
in
then,
fact, our
maybe
position
I don't
may...
understand it. Could just help me understand this, okay? If the statute says that nothing in the act shall affect the boundaries, and you're not claiming, you're not arguing about the boundaries either? Is that?
Well, if I can be clear on
please.
My position here.
Yeah, please.
These core lands are what's in dispute here.
Correct.
And we have ownership rights under NAGPRA and under our Aboriginal title, which NAGPRA incorporates.
Ownership rights to what?
To the cultural items only.
Not the land.
Not the land. But these cultural items are embedded in the land.
Yeah.
There's hundreds of them, thousands of cultural items all the way down and throughout the whole core land. And they're embedded in the land. And what is happening here is
what the core is doing is...
May I interrupt you? See, I'm as confused as Judge Tatel about your position here. Because we've got all this material in the brief... Mm-hmm. That's talking about the 1868 treaty mm-hmm. and the 1889 and so on and so forth. But if we put all that aside, it turns out it really doesn't matter to your claim. Because you're making a claim under an – now you're telling us, although I must say I did not get this out of your brief. You're making a claim under the Graves Act. Is that what –
It's in the complaint. I mean it's in our complaint.
I know it's in your complaint,
and it's in the judge's opinion.
Is there any exposition of that point in your brief? Maybe I just...
I thought we alluded to it in our brief. But if I may, let me just... So I'm perfect.
Your brief has got all this reservation boundary cases and then Decoteau and all the rest of them. And then you've got the... Somehow or another, you've woven in the Winner's Doctrine. How does the Winner's Doctrine have any effect on this case at all? It doesn't, does it?
Well,
and then now you're telling us, after all that, you're telling us that the case really doesn't depend on any of that. It depends on the Graves Act, which has a procedure for publication in the Federal Register and all the rest of it.
Yeah, perhaps it is confusing if I may respond.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, the Winner's Doctrine. We are not raising that in this case. It was raised in the context of Judge Kessler's opinion, where she said that there were subsequent acts of Congress that ratified this 1889 Act. And one of the acts she pointed to was in WARDA itself, where the Congress recognized and granted a permit to the Oglala Sioux tribe, a right-of-way in perpetuity across the core lands. But we pointed out that that act, that she is misinterpreting that provision of WARDA, because it's actually an amendment to Section 11 of the Miniwichoni Act, which created the Oglala Sioux Rural Water Supply System. And in the Section 11, it does refer to the Winner's Doctrine. That's how it came about. We aren't asserting rights under the Winner's Doctrine. We're just pointing out that Section 11 of the Miniwichoni Act states that nothing in this act shall be construed to diminish any rights of the Oglala Sioux tribe to the water project. So you can't construe that section of WARDA against the tribe in view of Section 11 of the Miniwichoni Act. That's how that came about. But our interest in this land is in the cultural resources, because we have ownership and control under NAGPRA. That's what NAGPRA says, ownership and control. And we complied with NAGPRA. We filed our claims. We indicated that we have the strongest claims.
Has the is the Corps of Engineers supposed to make a publication in the Federal Register? Is there a Federal Register procedure for the Corps of Engineers to publish something? I'm
not aware of any Federal Register procedure where the court is to do that, but our notices is in docket entry 14, our letters to the court, and Judge Kessler even acknowledged that in her opinion that we had filed that claim for these cultural items, and they are ownership rights, and they are the right to control, and when these lands are transferred to the state, we lose all that. We lose our ownership of these cultural items, even though we have them now. That's the harm, and we lose control under NACRA.
Wasn't that the subject of our earlier decision in this case? The Crow Creek case?
I'm sorry, Judge Taylor.
Wasn't that the subject of the Crow Creek decision?
No, Crow Creek was quite different.
It was?
In Crow Creek, the issue was whether they would be, these cultural items would be protected once they were transferred to the state, and this court ruled that the Crow Creek tribe utterly failed to show any harm because there were three statutes that protected cultural sites, and NACRA included, that would apply even under state ownership.
And why?
But our claim here is entirely different because we already have ownership and control of these cultural items. We complied with NACRA, and we're going to lose our ownership if these lands are transferred, because our interests, our ownership in these cultural items are going to be transferred to the state, and we feel that that's going to be irreparable harm and injury to the tribe, and we are asserting that the Corps is violating NACRA by doing this, because WARDA specifically states that you cannot transfer our ownership in these cultural items embedded in all this land to the state if it's within an existing reservation. We are asserting here that the boundaries of our diminished 1868 treaty reservation are still in fatigue for failure to comply with Section 28 of the 1889 Act.
That's my point about the statute, because your whole claim depends on the boundaries remaining intact, right?
It depends on the boundaries remaining intact, but we also have Aboriginal claims.
Okay, that was my next question. Can you explain to me what's the difference between your treaty-based claims, or your statute-based claims, and the trust claim or the Aboriginal claim?
I see my time's up, but I'll respond.
Yeah.
The treaty-based claims are recognized title. Article 5 of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty recognized title to all the core, to a 60 million acre area, including these core lands on the west bank of the Missouri River. Right. And the Indian Claims Commission held that the 51 Treaty recognized pre-existing Aboriginal title.
Right.
And then the 1868 Treaty reaffirmed that to the low water mark of the east bank. So we have traditionally established Aboriginal title under NACRA to all the core lands from the low water mark on the east bank of the river and the west bank. But furthermore, we also had an Aboriginal title claim where there was no treaty, and we proved that in the Claims Commission that we had Aboriginal title by showing that we occupied and used that area for a long time under the Court of Claims standards.
Under the 1889 statute, that land could not be transferred without a three-quarter vote, correct?
Yes.
That's the same land we're talking about.
Yes. The Section 28 was only for the reservation part, the Great Sioux Reservation part, and it provided that certain conditions had to be met in Section 28 before the Act would be valid. And the those conditions were not met. The district court, in fact, said that the requisite signatures were never obtained.
I mean, I realize I'm straying into the merits here, although it sounds like maybe we've been doing that all morning. But is it possible that the Aboriginal claims and the treaty-based claims are essentially merged in the 1889 Act? In other words,
No, they are not. The 89 Act only pertains to the reservation. The Aboriginal claims would not, are not affected by Section 28 of the 89 Act. And on those claims, we are just claiming a right of consultation prior to transfer on those Aboriginal claims where there's no treaty.
I know your time's up, but I just want to go back to a question that Judge Tato asked you. Is the harm that you allege the consequence of the transfer of the lands?
Yes, it is, because our ownership interest is being transferred without our consent and in violation of Article 12 of the 1868 Treaty. Well, we have ownership interest in all of those core lands, and that's the cultural items, and we own them under NAGPRA, and we have a right to control them, and we're losing all that.
Because you're losing it because the land is being transferred to the state?
That's correct. We're losing ownership.
So, you see, the problem is that that's directly contrary to what we held in this in the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe case. It says that the statute provides that the cultural protection laws will continue to apply to the transferred lands.
There's a distinction that has to be discerned here. In Crow Creek, the only issue was a protection of those cultural resources, not the ownership and control. The Crow Creek Sioux Tribe was conceding that they would be giving up ownership, essentially, to these lands and control to the state. We are not in this litigation. We don't want our ownership in those cultural items transferred to the state under WARDA.
So the difference between your case and Crow Creek is that not that you have a statute that wasn't decided in Crow Creek, contrary to your position, but that you're raising something that they actually conceded. They conceded that the ownership didn't matter to them. They wanted the artifacts protected.
They didn't raise that issue of ownership and control under Section 3002 of NAGPRA. The only thing that they were concerned about was that these items be protected, and this court ruled that they would be protected because of the three statutes that were made applicable in WARDA itself. This case is different because we do not want our ownership transferred along with, you know, the core lands. We do have ownership interests in those lands, and we feel that and control, and all of that will be lost once the lands are transferred. That's the harm that we are going to suffer here if these transfers are allowed to occur, and we don't think that under the statutory law, Section 28 of the 1889 Act, which we have shown here to be a nullity, we don't feel that they can transfer within the Great Sioux Reservation any of those lands. And I see my time's up, Your Honor.
We'll give you some time in reply. Thank you, Mr. Lundman.
May it please the court. I just want to start out with the Crow Creek case and what happened there. In that case, the claim made by the Crow Creek tribe was that NAGPRA, the Archaeological Act, and NEPA, those statutes would be, their protections would be diminished by the transfer of the lands. And this court clearly held that that was not the case under WERDA, that those protections would still apply just as if the Corps still held the lands.
But we didn't say anything about ownership, or they didn't say anything about ownership. Is that right? I know I was on it, Judge Tatel was on it, and I just read it, but I can't remember that distinction.
I don't think the decision goes into details about how NAGPRA exactly applies, because it applies the same way after the transfer as before. So whether there's a distinction between whether there's a right of ownership or other protections that apply under NAGPRA, they apply the same
under
way.
Under that statute, under the Graves statute, it's easier for me to – I haven't memorized all the acronyms, so if you just say the Graves statute. Does that confer ownership on tribes, or is it just that the federal government – holds these sacred objects in trust for the benefit of the tribe?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't know the exact distinctions there, and I think I have a legitimate defense for that, is that their complaint, their second amended complaint, which they filed after the Crow Creek decision, cites to NAGPRA, but neither of the four claims in that complaint reference NAGPRA at all. So that there's background material that cites to NAGPRA, but none of their claims are based on NAGPRA. And I didn't understand this case
neither did
to
I.
be going off on a NAGPRA ownership distinction.
No, neither did I.
I, I just don't think that's the way they've presented the case, both in their complaint to the district court, their Second Amendment complaint, and in their briefing here. Now, I think their original complaint.
You didn't even address the Graves Act, did you, in your brief?
I think it's mentioned in a footnote in the back statutory background section.
Yeah.
But it's if you read their four claims in this complaint. When you get the first claim, second claim, there's no mention of NAGPRA there. In any event, I don't think the exact NAGPRA protection that's at issue here matters with respect to whether Crow Creek is controlling with respect to this argument, because under Crow Creek,
I just want to back you up a little bit, because I don't know that that's fair. You say that you read their claims for relief and there's no mention of the Graves Act, but the fact is that each one of those claims for relief realleges the allegations in paragraphs 1 to 50, and the Graves Act is mentioned in paragraph 43, right?
Right. What I guess I'm missing is where there's identification of how the Corps and the other defendants has violated the Graves Act.
Yeah, that's another.
I mean, it describes what the Graves Act does.
The boundaries of the reservation.
Just looking at paragraph 43, it recites that Congress declared ownership or control of these artifacts. Is that correct? I mean, they're just paraphrasing, but does it say ownership or control, the statute?
You know, I to be honest, I don't know the answer to that question. You know, I don't think we've included it in our statutory addendum either. Because I didn't think it did not appear to be an issue after I read their opening brief in this sense.
Could we go directly to the issue that's before us here, which is standing?
Yes.
Okay. Why, in the crispest way you can, why does the tribe not have standing to bring the treaty or statutory-based claims here?
Well, there's two different reasons for their treaty-based claims, and one is they don't have standing because they don't have a legally protected interest in the transferring lands. And the second is...
But for purposes of standing analysis, I mean, that sounds like the merits. You sound like you're arguing a motion to dismiss. For purposes of standing, we have to assume the validity of their claims and then ask whether, assuming they're valid, are they injured and would they be redressable? And if so, then we address the merits. So don't we have to assume that they're right about the 1889 treaty never, or statute never becoming effective because of their claim that there was never a three-quarters vote?
Well, I think if it was a matter of factual dispute, that would be right. But when it's a matter of a pure legal issue of whether what happened over 100 years ago.
Well, they filed a complaint. They've made allegations. Do you agree with me about the way we're supposed to look at this for standing purposes?
Well, I think that's right, except that I think it depends a little bit on what part of the complaint you're discussing. What this is essentially saying is the 1889 Act and the 1890 Proclamation that followed didn't do what the courts have said it did and what they appear to do on their face. And I think when that
because they said there was never a valid three-quarters vote, and no other court has ever addressed that question.
That's right. This
okay,
court.
So don't we have to assume? In other words, for standing purposes, we say okay, they've made these allegations about. They say the Fort Laramie Treaty, the rights protected by the Fort Laramie Treaty. Are still valid. The boundaries recognized by it are still boundary. The 1889 statute never effectively transferred any lands. And so the lands that are being transferred under the Water Resources Act now are their lands. So for standing purposes, our cases are pretty clear about that. We have to, unless they're frivolous, we have to assume the validity of those claims and then ask whether, assuming they're right, there's injury, don't we?
I think you assume the validity of their claims, and we haven't argued to the contrary on this record here with respect to whether there was the three-quarters consent or not. They've alleged, as a matter of fact, that was not the case. Right. And the district court did not make a finding, as Mr. Gonzalez suggested, that that was the case, but rather you did the proper analysis.
You didn't move to dismiss or for summary judgment. You moved to dismiss the case for lack of standing.
Right, even though there was a show cause order that triggered this and not a motion, but
okay,
I think effectively the same result.
Yeah, okay.
So don't we
have to accept all that as true?
I think we accept as true for purposes here of whether the three-quarters consent was given or not, but I don't think
What do we do with that?
What do we do?
I didn't understand what you just said.
We accept their allegation that there's questions of fact and
right.
issues about the three-quarters consent
yeah.
being provided. But then we don't, but the legal question of whether what happened with the proclamation declaring it and that being binding because Congress said it was binding.
Why isn't that the merits?
I think there's clearly overlap with the merits, but
that's the trick with standing. And that's why we've said again and again, when you're addressing standing, I don't mean you, we've got to be careful not to stray into the merits. We have lots of cases that say that.
Right. I think there are, and then I think there are other cases that there's clearly some overlap between the merits question, for example, in the Crow Creek decision, and the ultimate standing determination. And
No, because in the Crow Creek decision, we assume they were absolutely right about their claims about sacred items and Indian land. We just said, assuming all that's true, those rights will be protected under the Act.
Right, and I think what I'm trying to say here is, assuming they're right about the issues they've identified with the three-quarters consent being
yeah.
provided, assuming that's true, what happened afterwards with the presidential proclamation, the Flood Control Act, the Rosebud suitcase?
Their arguments are their claim is that no land ever legally transferred because of the defects in the vote after the 1898 Act. That's their argument.
That's their argument.
Right.
Assuming the facts of their argument, I still don't think their argument carries the day and provides a legally protected interest, because the Act, 1889 Act, provided that the presidential proclamation was the manner in which the Act would either go into effect or not go into effect. And when that proclamation switch was turned on, then the 1889 Act went into effect. And then we have the subsequent legal history.
They can't relitigate that issue. They can't relitigate that issue. The Indian Claims Commission Act prohibits them from relitigating that issue. Isn't that the simplest answer to this?
I think that is a very simple answer to this, that the Indian Claims Commission
it's
Act.
It's conclusive to my
mind. But the transfer they're challenging occurred long after the Indian Claims Act, right? The transfer they're now challenging is a post-Indian Claims Act transfer.
That's right.
Do you know of any case that applies that bar to modern transfers of land?
No, but the only basis they have for that transfer to be improper or illegal is not something that occurred incorrectly under WERDA or any of the other statutes, but rather what occurred back in 1889 and 1890.
And that's barred by the Indian Claims Commission.
Right, and that's
what's
barred
that
by
got to do with standing?
Well,
that sounds like the merits.
I agree it sounds a little bit like the merits. The other point about standing I want to make is respect to the second and third prongs, which is causation and redressability.
Yeah.
The argument here being very similar to as in Crow Creek, especially with respect to the focus of their claims presented at argument, that the protections of those statutes apply as if the Corps still held the land. There's no, and as the Crow Creek Court held, there's no reduction in those protections. It's the same. And simply because those lands were transferred from federal ownership to ownership by the state does not reduce those protections. So that there's no causation of harm here based on the transfers, and there's no redressability. If the transfers were undone, those statutes would still apply if the transfers go forward or are undone. So we think those, in addition to the legally protected interest argument, support a lack of standing on redressability and causation, as the district court found.
Let me ask you about their other claim, their trust claim. Their claim, they have two claims, right? One is based on the treaty and the statute, and the other is their Aboriginal trust claim, right?
They have four claims, but I think the treaty-based claims, there's three of them. One, you can break them up in that.
But there is a separate Aboriginal claim. It's independent of those, right?
Well, they make a claim for I don't think their complaint is perfectly clear on this. They make a claim that there's been a lack of consultation.
Well, no, wait, here. They say, let's see. They say, okay, they have The treaty-based claims is two of those, right?
There's a total of three. The first three
claims. I'm looking at the one that says three, that the defendants owed a trust responsibility under these treaties, statutes, and the common law, which requires them to consult, right?
Right.
Okay, that's... Now, you didn't respond. I didn't see anything in your brief about that claim.
Well, I think the key is that trust responsibility is based on, as it says here in the complaint, the three treaties and federal statutory and common law, which they don't, I think, identify as separate basis. But those are, it's just like the first two claims. It's based on their treaty interests. And we...
Well, they claim that there's two separate claims. One is the treaty claim, which is recognized in the treaty. Another is their aboriginal claims to this land, which the courts have recognized, and which they say it's different in terms of the remedy because they're not arguing that the land can't be transferred. They're arguing that the trust relationship requires consultation. And that's a separate claim, at least in their complaint and their brief.
I think that is a separate claim.
Okay, and you didn't respond to that in your brief.
Well, I think we did in that sense that claim is founded on the property interest, and we've addressed the property interest directly in our brief, both on standing grounds and the other jurisdictional grounds we raised.
Is the merits. Let's assume you're wrong about that. Assume there's a separate aboriginally-based trust claim here.
Right, and they don't say aboriginally-based trust claim here in their complaint.
I don't
understand they're raising it now. And in their brief, they do cite a case from Canada on that point, but not any United States law supporting this aboriginal claim in this context where there was a treaty.
So you don't think this third claim is – you think this third claim is just their statutory claim?
I read it as a claim that in addition to having some sort of either ownership or – other interests in these lands, that interest, in addition to prohibiting the transfers prohibiting, also required imposed a duty to consult. So the duties they're asking, the duties on the core that they're claiming, flow from the same source. And we, in our brief, says that source doesn't provide what they say it does. So I think we did respond to it. I guess we didn't respond to it. Directly about aboriginal title, but
yeah,
I don't think they said
not at all. I mean, I didn't see it in your brief. So,
Have there been any adjudications of the boundaries of this particular reservation?
The Great Sioux Reservation or the Oglala Sioux?
Oglala.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe they've brought any. I'm not aware of any suits that have challenged the reservation boundaries of their reservation. That's one of the six created by the 1889 Act. I see my time is up. Unless the opposing counsel did not raise anything about the National Historic Preservation Act in his opening, no. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but otherwise rest on our briefs.
I want to make one observation to you. While you were arguing, I was listening in one ear and looking, and it really goes to something that I want to hear from Mr. Gonzalez. I went through rather rapidly, but the entire argument section and summary argument, a summary of argument section of the petition or of the tribe's brief, and then the reply brief of the tribe, and I don't find a single reference anywhere to the Graves Act in any of that material.
Mr. Gonzalez probably answered that. I don't recall much of one, or I think we would have addressed it.
But. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. He has no time. We'll give you 2 minutes, but before Judge Randolph asks you something, I want to ask you, come on up. All right. The NAGPRA says that the ownership or control of Native American cultural items shall be in the Indians if you do what you've said you've done, file these claims and so forth. Now, irrespective of whether Crow Creek talked about ownership, if NAGPRA protects or declares that ownership is in the tribe that files these claims and so forth, then the ownership as well as the control is not going to be transferred to the state of South Dakota.
Yes, it is.
How?
Because that's what's going to happen under WARDA, is these lands will all be transferred, including the ownership and control of the cultural items.
But MAG...
And in Crow Creek, Crow Creek did not raise ownership and control. I don't think they filed a claim for ownership and control.
MAG declares that the ownership will be in the tribe that files these claims. The ownership or control, they apparently, ownership and control means the same thing in that statute.
I think that the ownership and control will be in the state of South Dakota if the transfer occurs. We can't control them. I mean, it's already conceded that the state's going to...
Well, the control, I don't know about ownership, you know, that technicality, but I do know that the Crow Creek case held that the control remains in the federal government. The control of the cultural items remains in the federal government. That is the specific holding of the case, when you put it in terms of standing or not, and I do have some question about whether... That's a standing question.
But the Oglala Sioux tribe, not the federal government. And I have the NAGPRA statute, 3002, right here. And it says ownership and control in the tribe, not the federal government. We have the right to control those because we've complied with NAGPRA. And I want to respond to your question about...
Why isn't that in your brief? It's not... am I wrong that
I think we have alluded to it in a brief, and maybe we can point that out... after we get time to review it. But I just want to point out the district court's opinion here on page 8 of the opinion. The court states that, in particular, the Native American Graves Protection Act declared ownership and control over human remains, associated and unassociated funerary objects, sacred objects, items of cultural patrimony, excavated or discovered on federal or tribal lands to be vested in lineal descendants or Indian tribes.
Mr. Gonzalez, so that's all fine, but we have rules here, and one of the rules is you cannot get up in an oral argument and make an argument that you've never made in your brief. And you have, I don't see that argument in your, I don't see any argument about this statute in your brief, and I don't see any argument about it in the summary of argument, and I don't see any argument about it in the reply brief.
Yeah. Well, my recollection is that we did mention it in our brief, but I'll have to look at the briefs, because they are extensive. But I just want to just finish the district court's statement here on page 8 and 9. Here's what the district court stated. On December 2001, plaintiff notified the court pursuant to NAGPRA that it claims ownership and control of all Native American cultural items excavated or discovered intra alia at all of the recreational areas and other lands that are subject to this action. So, you know, there's a finding here that by the district court that we did make a claim for ownership and control.
Did the Corps of Engineers deny that?
Pardon?
Did the Corps of Engineers deny that claim? What was the response?
Well, the Corps of Engineers is denying it by transferring our interest in these, our ownership and control, not the government's ownership and control, but the tribe's ownership and control is going to be transferred to the state.
What, did you get a letter back from the Corps of Engineers?
If you look at... docket entry 14. Those we have the notices we sent to the Corps from the tribe, and in the notices we indicated signed by Teresa Tubels, who was vice president at the time, that there was a response, I believe, from Mr. Ubalady from the Corps. So I think the Corps acknowledged that they received our notice.
That's all. They just acknowledged it. You got no other response.
That's my recollection. Is that's all that's indicated, is that there was an acknowledgement that they received our notices. So they were put on notice that we were claiming ownership and control. Thank you, Your Honor.
They have to follow that act as well as you do. I mean, what they have to follow, they can't say no. Any more questions?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Your Honors.